So refresh my memory a little bit, Bill. Oh, Blue Highways came out when?
Hardback 83 and the paperback the next year. And I was here in January of both years, I think.
83, so yeah.
8 years from the first one.
Yeah. Well, you haven't been resting on your laurels or just riding around in a lonely camper. You've actually been doing a lot of work over the past 8 years or so, haven't you? I guess maybe people who thought that Blue Highways was a fluke, that this was a beautiful, beautiful book and could not be duplicated or even excelled, were wrong, because Prairie Earth, you know, it's a glory. I like it even better.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear that.
And it's hard to top yourself, but I really think you did, so I want to congratulate you on that. But at any rate, you spent, I guess you had a period of time where you had to make up your mind about what you were going to do after Blue Highways, is that correct?
No, I did have the idea for Prairie Earth by the time that I finished Blue Highways. In fact, the two ideas came at about the same time in 1974. It's that I followed through on the Blue Highways idea first. Both ideas began as notions for stories for the National Geographic. But by the time that Blue Highways came off the presses and was appearing around the country, I was starting to make some initial efforts to try to put Prairie Earth together. But it took me 3.5, maybe 4 years of gathering material before I knew how to hook all of these stories that I was hearing in the Flint Hills of Kansas. How would I hook those together? Finally, I came across this notion of the grid, using the 12 U.S. Geological Survey maps that mark the county, using those as a kind of archaeologist grid to lay across the country, across the county, and then proceeded to walk those. So that Prairie Earth is a book about a single place, but it's a book also in which the traveler moves by foot instead of by wheels, as in Blue Highways.
Well, it was especially interesting to me, being a native Kansan myself from Wichita, which I believe is only about 50 miles south of Chase County. Isn't that correct?
Something yes, like even that. Even closer if we could go by air, but by road, yes, you're right.
And you yourself, you're from Kansas City, aren't you?
I'm from Kansas City, Missouri. Some people in the east or in the west, too, don't realize that there are two Kansas cities. I come from the Missouri side, and that's a bit like a New Yorker writing about New Jersey, or perhaps an Englishman writing about France, for me to venture across the state line and try to write about Kansas. But I would say that Prairie Earth really is not just about Kansas any more than, if I can say this, that William Faulkner's Mississippi novels are not just about Mississippi. Yakutatawpha County becomes a kind of metaphor for the South and indeed really much of America. And I hope that this place in the Flint Hills in Kansas is representative of concerns and issues that we all face in the country everywhere.
Well, they are a little different in that the Midwest, generally the rural Midwest, as you well point out in Prairie Earth, is quite depressed. And Chase County is no exception.
That's true. The people who are there, well, in a sense, they weathered the long, long depression, if that's the word for it. And the ones who are there now are the ones who have been able to hang on. But nevertheless, they must pay the price for living in a county that is steadily losing people. The population today is almost the same as it was in 1873, for example. It's a third of what it was at its peak. That's not entirely a bad thing, of course. Economically, it can make it difficult. But for somebody who wants to get out and walk uncluttered miles of tall grass prairie and to come close to seeing something of what the middle of America can be or was before white settlement, this is not a bad place to do it in.
You mentioned the tall grass prairie, and you write in Prairie Earth that there's quite a debate over whether or not to federally preserve this grassland. And apparently many of the people in Chase County are not particularly interested in doing that.
The National Park Service has not a single representation of tall grass prairie in it. There's no place that American can go today in a national park and visit tall grass prairie. But yet it's a landform that ran from places in Ohio all the way to nearly halfway across Kansas and in almost from border to border. We're talking about a good many 1,000 square miles that Tallgrass Prairie once covered. Today, try to find tallgrass anywhere in the country. It's very difficult to do. So we really do need in our national park system a park showing, representing that particular kind of landform.
What is tallgrass exactly?
Well, it's a number of kinds of grasses. The greatest of the tall grasses is Big Blue Stem, a plant that can reach 10 feet in height. Then there's Little Blue Stem, which grows on the drier slopes, and it would be, at its maximum, less than half that. There's Indian grass, slough grass, side oats grama. In Chase County alone, we've identified 78 different kinds of grasses in that county, most of them native grasses. So when we speak of tall grass, we're talking about a range of grasses growing from well over the height of a man to down to about knee height. The old story in the Flint Hills is that a century and a half ago, an Indian could be before coming to the white man and the change in pasturing habits, the cutting of the grasses, the burning of the grasses, an Indian could be crossing through a tall grass section and get into a particularly thick stand of say Big Blue Stem and have to stand up on his horse to see over the top of it to see where he was going. It wasn't common, but it did happen from time to time.
Well, let's go back a little ways. Why did you select this particular area? You could have, of course, in your van on those blue highways, I guess you could have selected just about any spot in the United States, but you selected Chase County, Kansas. Why this location?
I think I first was attracted by the name Flint Hills. That struck me as a region that was worth exploring. At the center of the Flint Hills is Chase County, and the county seat is Cottonwood Falls. That was another name I was attracted to. I drove out, I looked around, and I found that this community, this area, seemed to exist almost in a kind of time warp. While the ranchers and farmers are driving pickup trucks, many of their other concessions or accommodations with the 21st century were either non-existent or very slight. The big change you could see is that instead of moving by horse, by cart, by buggy, a wagon, they now are moving by pickup trucks. But otherwise, so much of the 19th century was still there. But yet, here we are nearly into the 21st century. And it seemed to me that this was a place that was going to be forced to go from the 19th century to the 21st without having much time in between. So it seemed to compress history in a way. I thought perhaps I could look at a region, at a community that was under that kind of stress and find something about the stress that all of us are facing in going from the 19th century into the 21st.
Now, you have a number of drawings in Prairie Earth, including an aerial depiction of Cottonwood Falls, which looks as though it may have been drawn in the 1890s, 1880s, somewhere in there. How has Cottonwood Falls changed since that time and since that picture was drawn?
It was done in 1878, and I can take that as I have, take that drawing today and stand from what is close to the point of view of the man who drew it, and the town of Cottonwood Falls is still quite recognizable. And that's 100 and some years ago. The changes have been that slow. It's an unusual thing, as we all know in this country, for change to come over a century and come so slowly that we still can recognize a place. It's a gift that you find, say, in the best English villages. You can go back year after year after year, and you can look back at early drawings, paintings of certain English villages, and they still are recognizable. Not so easy to do in this country.
Well, it's obvious you made repeated visits to Cottonwood Falls and that area. How were you received? Were you a stranger butting in to other people's lives at first, or were you eventually accepted?
Well, yes to both. I at first was a stranger asking too many questions. Once the people understood that I was interested in writing a book, they accepted as a plausible reason for asking questions, and I think they accepted me. I became known around the county after a while as that book writer, that guy writing the book, and that gave reason enough to ask questions, to take notes, to walk a great deal. Walking in the county is generally something that you do either because your car is broken down or you're eccentric. So I apparently fell into that second category of the eccentric. I was always the outsider, And there's no way, not being born in the county, that I could ever become anything else. So I accepted that as my designation. And I became the outsider who asked the questions. And I think, like people everywhere, when somebody comes in and is interested in listening to someone's story, that someone will begin speaking and will speak almost as long as the reporter could wish him to speak.
What about the logistics of your travel? Where did you stay? Where did you eat?
Well, I was doing everything in the county at first. There's only one motel there in the entire county, and it isn't much. It's pretty grim. And after a while, I gave up on that. It was the light bulbs were so of such low wattage, I couldn't read at night. I couldn't do any work, so I shifted and moved to the next county. But I took virtually all my meals in the county. Sometimes carrying my food with me when I was hiking. At other times, going into the cafes. There were nights when everything was closed up. I'd be in the field all day, come in after dark, and would end up with a meal of pickled turkey gizzards at Darla's bar. It's a meal that you really don't want to eat unless you have to, but when you've been in the field and it's been cold most of the day, it's tolerable.
Well, you have a wonderful story about eating some raw hamburger created for you on the bar top itself by a man with axle grease on his hands. Tell me about that.
That was also in Darla's. I came in from the prairie one evening. Everything was closed up. The only food available was either, once again, the pickled something, turkey gizzards or pig's feet, whatever. I wasn't in the mood for those. And the fellow next to me drank part of a beer, got up, went down to the grocery and bought some raw hamburger and a loaf of white bread, came back and began making raw hamburger sandwiches. And I looked at it, and I must have been looking as if it were steak tartare, because he soon was making me one. I loaded it down with jalapeno peppers and Tabasco sauce, and it was tolerable. I would just as soon been able to spread it myself, since he'd been in a crankcase most of the day, but that may have added just a bit more flavor to disguise the raw meat.
Of course, Cottonwood Falls for a time did have a rather popular cafe, didn't it?
In the middle 80s, two women, one with a Ph.D. in educational psychology, came back to the county. She had grown up there, had been gone for a number of years. She came back to fulfill a long dream of running a little hometown cafe in her home place. So she bought a closed restaurant, cleaned it up, opened it up, and began serving foods that many of the countyans found quite exotic, things such as linguine, a word that they had no idea. What is this? Crepes. What is a crepe? This was their introduction to new foods which a lot of us now take for granted, and they came to like it. There was some resistance, but I think generally many of them enjoyed these new foods. But once again, they were going from 19th century food to late 20th century foods with no intervening warning. Just was overnight. They had been eating chicken fried steak, and the next day the cafe opened, and they could go in and eat Italian foods that they'd never dreamed of before.
Well, you used the term caught in a time warp. Is that correct for Cottonwood Falls and environs? And it's really a place suspended in history to a degree.
Yeah, another term I use for it seems to be a kind of still point near the heart of the nation. If we took a paper map of the United States and folded it east to west, then north to south, where the creases would cross would nearly be in Chase County. In other words, this place lies virtually at the heart of America. In fact, it's about 130 air miles from the geographical center of the contiguous 48 states. So here at the heart of America, it seemed to me, was a kind of still point, a place that was not moving at the same pace with the rest of the country. And once again, if we think of a still point, we think of a nation in revolution, that is turning, we know the outside is going to be covering a greater distance than the inside. So I was intrigued with that notion, that here at the center of the pinwheel, the center seemed to be revolving less fast.
Well, what about outside communications, cable television, newspapers, magazines, radio?
Well, they certainly television they do get, and they hear the new music. They do see some movies. There is one movie today in the county, open on Saturday night and Sunday night. And even though the movies might be a bit out of date by the time they get there, they do eventually see them. But I think that belongs to a kind of dream world for them. They know that somewhere those things are out there, but so often the materials that go into TV films and movies are not really much a part of their lives, other than something that occurs briefly across the screen at night during some entertainment. They still must make their way by the old demands of cattle and grain coming up.
What about medical care and shopping and things like that? Cottonwood Falls doesn't seem to be a place where you could do a lot of that.
It's difficult. There are a few clothing stores there. There's one grocery in Cottonwood Falls and another a couple miles north in Strong City. Otherwise, they have to leave the county to buy most things that they need. If they need an automobile, if they need a new pair of spectacles, if they want the latest novel, they've got to leave the county to find those. Medical care has diminished almost entirely in terms of a resident physician or dentist. Although, just in the past few weeks, they do now have another doctor coming in. So things may be looking up on that count. But mostly, for the last several years, they have had to depend upon things that a city person assumes is just down the street. They've had to know that they're going to leave the county to find that help.
You actually make Cottonwood Falls appear to be a very attractive town, which could, under certain circumstances, be a tourist attraction.
Well, I think it can. The commercial district is about three blocks long. It runs along one street, Broadway. Broadway leads from the Cottonwood River up a nice brick street to the courthouse, which is a marvelous Second Empire story limestone building, one of the stellar structures in Kansas, and one of the fine courthouses in the Union, as a matter of fact. It's the oldest courthouse still serving ends of justice in the state of Kansas, and it may soon qualify there west of the Mississippi. And there's a great deal of native stone architecture still along the street of Cottonwood Falls, as there is throughout the county. Something else that drew me there is the stone architecture, native stone architecture, which has a distinct style that you find in the Flint Hills. And no place in the Flint Hills is there more of it, or is it more clearly shown than in Chase County.
Well, you mentioned the courthouse with the clock long stopped, I think, at 4:30 in the afternoon, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe morning, somewhere along that time. But you got quite a bit of mileage out of learning about the jail in town.
They closed the jail just a few years before I started roaming around in the county. One county and thought that was an odd thing to do. The reason they closed it, I should say, is that there's no fire escape for it. And if there's a fire, whoever's up there was likely to stay in that jail until the fire was over.
No, it's in the courthouse.
That's in the courthouse. That's at the back of the courthouse. And one county thought it very strange that the reason that they closed down the jail was there's no escape from it, because he understood that was the purpose of a jail, a place that you don't escape from, even if there's a fire there. But it's... They've maintained the jail since they closed it, and a visitor today can go into the courthouse and ask to be shown to the jail and walk in these very strange iron cages that they used in the 19th century and read scratched in the paint of these cells the memos and messages that the men from earlier times left as they were counting off their days. They would enumerate their crimes. They would tally the days they had to go, the days they had done. They would write notes to each other. One drew a picture of a book. There are pictures of nude figures, as you can imagine, in men locked up as they were. It's a kind of ledger, if you will, of crime in the county, seen from the point of view of the inmates themselves.
How is crime and law enforcement handled, especially with the closing of that jail?
Well, they take the prisoners now off to the next county over to incarcerate them. But that's another change coming to the county. They just a couple of weeks ago broke ground to build a new jail separate from the final courthouse. The reason they're building this new jail is they found out that they could make money keeping other people's prisoners. So instead of paying money to send the prisoners out, they're going to use a jail as a means of income to help underwrite other things in the county. That may be one clear indication of the economic stress that this place lives under right now.
Well, the county has had a violent past, as you point out. I guess the term Bloody Kansas was not created for nothing. But it still seems, by modern standards, a very peaceful place to live.
It is. There hasn't been a murder in the county since, I guess, the 70s. But the old saying that's still alive, at least around the county and the county surrounding Chase, is that if you want to kill a man and get away with it, do it in Chase County, Kansas. But I think those days are long gone. Although I must say the last murder that did occur there in the 70s, the man was not tried. He wasn't even arraigned. It seemed like such a case of self-defense that's as people accepted that, and that was as far as it went.
What about the geography? It's not all flat the way we picture Kansas.
No, the popular notion of Kansas outside of the state itself is that it's a flat place, and it is not that. In fact, the western end is 3,000 feet or more higher than the eastern end, so we've got a difference, say, of about three Empire State Buildings stacked up there, difference in height. So if it is a pool table, it's a very tilted pool table. But the region I speak of, write about, is the Flint Hills. And these are truly hills. They're not mountains, but they are noteworthy hills. They become even more like hills when you spend 8 years hiking them, walking them, as I did. They may be somewhat more modest if you drive through them. But to put on a backpack and hike into the tall grass prairie in the Flint Hills, you will never say that Kansas is flat.
Now, you point out very well in Prairie Earth that the weather is a big concern there with the tornadoes and dust storms, and I guess there are no dust storms now, but tell me a little bit about how the weather impacts Chase County.
Well, it's I guess I could say it this way, that the people there are more animated by weather than they are by religion. The thing that they pay attention to more than any other single thing, I think, is the weather, because their livelihoods depend upon whatever's going on in that sky. But it's also another reflection of the sky being so evident. When you get out into the pastures, into the prairie, you have not just 360 degrees of horizon, but you have the horizon right at eye level. You have the sense when you're on a hill that you're standing in the sky itself, that the top of your head is actually thrusting into the sky. So that makes you pay attention to that way, for that reason. In fact, when they get a tornado warning, these people do not run for shelter. They go out to their houses, out into the Broadway, wherever they happen to be when they hear the warning, to look to see the storm coming. And they watch it come on. And when they decide that, yes, it's coming our way, then they may move to shelter. But they stand and watch the tornadoes come through. And it's, three dinners with a wonderful couple, Paul and Leola Evans, who are in their 70s. Three dinners with them. It interviewed them for, maybe 6 or 7 hours before they let slip that years ago they had been taken aloft in a tornado, carried out of their house, carried out through down the living room, down the hallway, through the living room, out through the wall that the tornado took away, picked up once, sat down, and picked up again some 60 yards away. They told me this story as if it was something that I should know and happened to everybody. Mm-hmm. And it isn't true. That doesn't happen to everybody in Kansas. But in a sense, they had lived through what Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz lives through. They had been aloft in the tornado twice in that night and both survived.
Now, there seems to be a lot of mythology about tornadoes as related to you by some of the residents in town. I don't know whether to completely believe it or not. But another thing that's important, water. I mean, flooding, it's in a flood zone, isn't it? Or part of the county is in a flood zone.
Most of the roads, well, I shouldn't say most of the roads, but the main crossing roads do go through the drainages of the Cottonwood and the South Fork rivers, so that the communities also are built in these bottoms, in these hollows. And both the South Fork and the Cottonwood, draining the hills as they do, take a lot of runoff quickly when it does start raining. The last great flood was in 51, although there have been numerous floods since then. That was the biggest one in any living memory. There's a town there in Chase County called Saffordville, which was virtually wiped out by the flood of 51. The people picked up their church after the flood and moved it several miles north. They picked up many of the commercial buildings. They even picked up some of the sidewalks. They were native stone sidewalks, moved them north. But there were four families that decided, we're not moving, we're staying here. and they have stayed on since that flood of 51 in their homes. And when the river rises and starts coming up the basement steps at them and eventually into the living rooms and the kitchens, all they do is move to the second floor. I mean, they have time to get out. The boats come in, even if they didn't, and take them away. They won't leave. They stay in their houses. Then when the water starts draining, the women take their mops and their brooms and keep the water swirling, walk around and around through the rooms, moving the water, keeping it in a kind of a whirlpool, so that as it drains out, the silt goes out with it. And that's about their only accommodation to the cottonwood. Otherwise, Tom and Sybil Bridge, for example, the water comes in, floods the kitchen, they go upstairs. But when it's time for meals, they put on their rubber boots and they go downstairs and sit at the kitchen table in 3 feet of water.
How many times did you visit Chase County? It's been hundreds, huh?
Well, the total number of trips over there, I guess, would have 30 or 40 over my time. And the longest I ever stayed at anyone in any one spell was 3 weeks. So it was a compressed visiting, I guess you could say, even though it did occur over 8 years.
Well, you packed a lot of learning in that short amount of time. But there's even more. You did a lot of research because each chapter opens up with quotations about Kansas or about things that might apply to that area. So you did a lot of homework.
The subtitle of Prairie Earth is A Deep Map, and one of the things that I use to try to draw the reader into the deep map are these quotations. They appear at the first of each big unit in the book. I call them commonplace books. A commonplace book is something we've kind of stopped doing in this country, but in another time, Americans or Europeans would collect quotations that they particularly found apt to their lives, record them in notebooks, so that after a while, a person would accumulate a series of quotations which became almost a biography hyphen autobiography of their lives. This is what they found valuable as they lived. What I try to do is to suggest to the reader notions that will draw them into the depth of history that lies over this section of the Flint Hills of Kansas. I've called the book A Deep Map. The other aspect is when I was traveling Blue Highways, I was moving pretty much horizontally. You could see me moving in a sense in one dimension, the length of a mile, say. I started thinking as I moved, wouldn't it be nice to travel, say, in terms of square miles? And then I started thinking beyond that, what if I wasn't moving in terms of squares so much as in terms of cubes? If we had a cube of Earth that was a mile in all of its dimensions, what would it be like to try to travel within that cube? So Prairie Earth is an attempt to travel within the land as well as across the surface of it, to move in its time. And the commonplace books are one feature of drawing the reader into times past, which I assume are important because they suggest times future.
Now, how did you go about researching the history of the county?
Well, I relied initially upon the people themselves to direct me, listen to them, let them tell me what they knew, what sources they knew. It was also particularly useful in that this particular county, they have put together 4 volumes of historical sketches about their lives there. They began doing this, the first publication came out, was assembled during the 30s, when many of the original pioneers were, although old, still alive and could tell tales about the first settlement of the county. In other words, they could take memories back to the 1860s, so that we have a first-hand record of the settlers in this place. And you can go from volume 1 through volume 4 in some cases and follow a single family through its generations. That was immensely helpful, those 4 volumes. It's the kind of thing every county should have.
Is that at the courthouse?
No, it's been published. You can find these in the people's homes. And I they're for sale there. I went in, I bought the 4 volumes and went home and started reading.
Where do you buy them?
Well, I think you can get them in the Historical Society. You can get them in some of the offices. The furniture store there, I think, is the place I bought my copies.
Well, what about Prairie Earth? Is that on sale in Cottonwood Falls?
It is. We officially released Prairie Earth on Saturday. I had no idea what the reception of the book would be.
Were you there?
I was there, and I was afraid that some of my views aren't entirely in accordance with the natives. I am an environmentalist, and I think Prairie Earth makes some pretty strong statements about that. Not everyone there is happy with those. There is a, some. There have been problems of racism in the county. I talk about those things. So I was a little bit unsure about what would happen with the reception, but it turned out that it was a tremendous thing. There are only 3,000 people in the whole county, and in that on Saturday we sold 1,500 copies of the book. Some of the people who came through the line for me to sign the book, I had heretofore thought that they were illiterate, and it may be perhaps they are, but yet they may have been buying the book for almost as a memento perhaps of the event. But I was delighted to see that even though they may not agree with me on each individual topic, that they wanted to they were curious enough to see what some outsider is going to say about this particular place. That's
now, was
theirs.
This a publication party? How did it work out exactly?
It was the official launch of Prairie Earth, I guess we could say it that way.
Where was it held?
It was held on the courthouse lawn in Cottonwood. They put me in the rumble seat of a 1929 Model A and hauled me down Broadway, which means down a couple of blocks there. And they'd set up a big flatbed trailer and decorate it with crepe paper. And I went up onto the flatbed truck and made a 10-minute speech and introduced many of the people of the county who appear in the book. And we took a photograph of all those of us who are still alive who appear in the book, and then we went to the signing, and it went on for 3.5 hours.
Houghton Mifflin shipped a lot of copies out there.
Yeah, the earliest copies released went to Chase County, even though the county didn't let the people see the book until Saturday, and it turned out that other people, other Kansans around, were reading the book, and the Chase Countyans hadn't. They weren't able at that point to get their copies.
Now, to whom was the shipment delivered?
Oh, the
who handled it, the arrangements?
The people put together a little committee called the Prairie Earth Committee, and there are five or six of them who assembled things and put it together. Did a marvelous job.
So you were glad you weren't run out of town on a rail.
I was relieved at that, and more possibly I was delighted to see their excitement at this. They have a few celebrations in the county annually. They have an annual rodeo, and they have something called Chase County Days. So they're used to celebrations, but they've never had one quite like this before.
Well, did you have to give copies of the book to your prime contacts?
Oh, yeah. I sent out as gifts a number of copies to the people who appear in the book. Yes.
Well, it's a beautiful book. Oh, well, one other question, Bill. Are you still teaching?
No,
it should be noted that you have been a longtime teacher and academic, and not just an itinerant voyager along the blue highways of the United States.
Well, I hope I've been a teacher, but I hope I haven't been ever an academic. But I did teach in the university system of Missouri for a while, and also at Stevens College in Columbia, Missouri. But I haven't taught now for 5 or 6 years.
So you've spent the entire effort working on Prairie Earth.
Yeah, Prairie Earth is 624 pages, pretty condensed pages, and it took all of my time just to get this book finished now. And I must say that it's 6 years late to the publisher as it is.
6 years late?
6 years late. I thought it would take me a couple of years to do it. Instead, it took nearly eight.
Well, what's next for William Least Heat Moon? Are you going to stay with Rural America and focus on that for your next effort?
I'm not sure, Don. I think that the thing that moves me most of all topics is the land and our relationship with the land. So whatever I do, I think will have something to do with that. I'm thinking now about a book having something to do with water, waterways, rivers, perhaps coasts, but more likely lakes, interior waterways. I'm actually casting about trying to find people who live on the water, who make a living from rivers, who float rivers, especially in large craft.
That's a fascinating idea. I was thinking about this area in Wisconsin that my father would take us when we were kids. And there was an area in northern Wisconsin called the Flambeau Floyge. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. And they purposely dammed some waterways up there, and this Floyd's extended for miles and miles and miles, covering homes and trees. And I would go up there, and this is lake country, but why they needed more water, I have no idea. But I would stand along the Floyd's, which was like a vast sea, and you could see the tree stumps, dead trees out there, but the water hadn't quite covered yet. But this was a man-made effort to do it. You look on the map, you'll see it. It's Flambeau Floyd. And I always wondered about that. I always wondered about the people who lived there and who were flooded out and why they felt they needed more water, the motive for doing it. This happened, I guess, in the 1940s, 1950s, when they built that Floyd up there. It's near Park Falls in Mercer, in Wisconsin. And just throw it out because your idea fascinates me because, you know, water is important to us wherever we are, including people who live inland.
Oh, it's going to become more so. The changes in our use and attention to water that you're describing here, it's happened all across the face of the country. It's a question of wetlands. It's the question of cleanliness of rivers, of lakes, of flowage, of aquifers. It's an issue that, in so many ways, is going to become perhaps the environmental issue of the early 21st century.
And I'm sure that whatever you do, if you do focus on the water, you'll humanize it, how people are affected by water and the changes in water.
Yes, I'm not a nature writer as such, although I often end up having to talk about things that somebody might call nature writing. But my interest always is the relationship between us, humankind, and the land. If there's a single notion behind Prairie Earth, it's that that we belong to the land, not the other way around.
Well, Prairie Earth, it's a beautiful book, William Least Heaton. And thank you very, very much for stopping in and talking to me.
Thanks, Don.
I'm glad you're hyphenating your last two names. I didn't know whether to categorize you under L, under H, or under M.
Well, librarians are having trouble with it, too, so that's supposed to help. Yeah.
Hang on.